Chapter 12. Determination in the pursuit of folly is the indulgence of fools. We are more afraid of losing what we have than not getting what we want. A well-researched rule of life. The most lethal combination of character traits for men and nations turns out to be arrogance allied to ignorance. Knowledge helps us manage fear. Stupidity thrives in the absence of curiosity and is frequently disguised by ambition and a relentless perseverance that can be a virtue only when the path chosen is informed and comports with reality. Passion can ennoble or destroy us, depending on the wisdom that directs it. We live at the mercy of fools. They are everywhere. Their defining characteristics, a lack of comprehension, judgment, or common sense, are on frequent display among both our political representatives and the people who elect them. They exhibit an inability or unwillingness to learn from experience, and their grasp of basic information is frequently shaky. Consider this account of Paul Revere's ride from a leading politician on a trip to Boston. He who warned the British that they weren't going to be taking away our arms by ringing those bells and making sure, as he was riding his horse through town, to send those warning shots and bells that we were going to be secure and we were going to be free. What does such a statement say about this person's understanding of American history? When we hear people holding forth on the Constitution who grasp little of its meaning, when they extol the Founding Fathers as fundamentalist Christians, when they assert the Civil War was not fought over slavery, more is revealed than an imperfect education. A further indicator of foolishness is a contempt or lack of understanding of the scientific method, that objective mode of inquiry that for 400 years has been our best means of understanding our world. This approach to new knowledge requires systematic observation, measurement, and experiment, and the formulation, testing, and modification of hypotheses. The scientific method forswears evidence-free argument and has proven the only reliable escape from the magical thinking that preceded it. When contention is based instead on prejudice or religious belief, we have wandered into the realm of fools. When people deny the role of humans in climate change or dismiss evolution as a theory to be taught to our children alongside creationism, they are revealing a misperception of, even disdain for, reality that is both uninformed and dangerous. When our understanding of the world is largely defined by an ancient text, be it the Bible or the Quran, we have left the pursuit of testable hypotheses and the experimental method and entered the area where our primary source of argument in all areas is clouded by a set of unverifiable beliefs. At a time when an unacceptable percentage of our workforce is unemployed, for example, many in our governments are preoccupied with issues that flow from religious convictions about when life begins. In a sense, this is a break with reality of the sort that afflicts people struggling with psychotic thinking. A hallmark of psychosis is delusional thought that is the product of false beliefs. And so it is with government when it is preoccupied with faith-based arguments at moments that call for reality-based solutions. When the image of ourselves does not comport with the truth of our actions, we are also prone to terrible mistakes. For example, Americans like to see themselves as a peace-loving people who fight with others only when we or our core values are threatened. Yet we look back upon 70 years of more or less continual engagement in war. This attempt to bend the world to our needs and desires has had a spotty record of success and has cost us dearly. Although the analogy is imperfect, if we were as aggressive in our personal lives as we have been as a nation, we would likely be in jail. Once again, we confront the disconnect between reality and ideology. If we fight for freedom, Can we not ask ourselves how much freer we are than when we went to war in Vietnam or Iraq? Are we really learning from experience? Primitive man lived in an atmosphere of fear. Faced with continual threats to his life by other larger animals and confronted with a natural world he could not explain, he developed survival instincts that were adaptive at the time. For protection, he adopted kinship groups that expanded into larger communities that were more efficient at hunting, agriculture, and self-defense. It is only when these groups began to fight with each other over territory or food that the seeds of war were planted. As the weapons used became more destructive, we progressed to a situation in which all human life was threatened by differences among nation-states over ideologies, concerning how best to organize society, politically and economically. We survived 40 years of nuclear standoff in the 20th century. When the communist side of the conflict crumbled economically, there was a brief hope that we might begin to settle differences without the threat of war. Soon, though, in the face of an atrocity by a relatively small group of religious fanatics, we declared ourselves at war again, and have behaved in the ensuing 10 years as if our entire way of life were threatened by people willing to blow themselves up. It can be argued that if a nation spends 6% of its gross national product, $24 billion each year on the military, it will find a way to use these forces. I think that the causes for our present martial, not to be confused with marital, adventures lie deeper in our vulnerability to fear and the cohesiveness that fear provides. In a society that contains many different conceptions of how we should be organized, how we should educate our children, how we treat the poor, how our considerable resources should be expended, we can all agree on a few things. Our wars are presumably subject to debate as well. But a certainty among nearly all of us is that the highest calling, deserving of universal respect and adulation, is the role of soldier. The flag-waving and parades that are routine accompaniments to our national holidays are orgies of patriotism that draw us together in a celebration of our presumed American exceptionalism. It is hard to imagine, by contrast, a similar acknowledgement of Peace Corps volunteers. Perhaps this unifying effect of war is inevitable. We all are brought together by perceived threats. But this unity has its drawbacks. We too easily become attached to the primitive idea that the best way to live in an uncertain and dangerous world is to project our military power whenever we feel threatened. Conflict is so much more interesting than negotiation, which is why violence plays such a large role in our entertainment industry. Violence carries with it the illusion of control. If we are strong enough, no one can harm us, and we will always have our way. If this were a correct analysis of how the world works, we would fear nothing. Violence is also commonly presented as the shortest path to peace. If that were true, we would have been at peace for some time now. In fact, it appears to be the preparation, even enthusiasm, for war that makes us so quick to engage in it. The adage applies: if your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. So here's the argument. We have plenty of stupidity to go around. When this trait finds expression in a philosophy of government that extols selfishness and the use of force to get our way in the world, we are all in danger. We must eventually reject this kind of response to anxiety and uncertainty, not simply because it is morally wrong, but because it doesn't work. The same might be said of that other popular form of institutionalized vengeance, the death penalty. The country has endured threats to its existence in the past without wavering on the rights of all human beings and a determination to act within the laws we have established. Our willingness to suspend these rights, even to torture people as a matter of national policy, is a recent phenomenon related to the fears that flowed from a horrifyingly national catastrophe. When these fears became politically useful, they were fanned by people who benefited from a frightened constituency. We were reflexively convinced that two wars were justified, and that, in fact, these conflicts were just the beginning of a long twilight struggle with religious fanatics who derive their power from their ability to terrorize us. Over the last 10 years, we have lost and taken many lives and spent more than we can afford in the service of our anxiety. Whether we have learned anything in return remains to be seen. Chapter 13. Courage can be taught only by example. And what he greatly thought, he nobly dared. Homer. After we have defined courage as a choice to confront our fears, we wonder how to both express and teach this virtue to our children. The lecture method will not work here, and our schools have little room in their curricula to teach virtue, even if they knew how. No matter how much we wish to be safe, life gives us many opportunities to be brave. If only in the ways we age, experience loss, treat each other, and face our mortality. Of all the forms of courage that we celebrate, physical courage is the easiest to recognize, which is why we make heroes of our athletes. The kind of fortitude required to endure pain and face injury while displaying skill on the playing field is easy to observe and universally admired. Athletics provide our most reliable meritocracy. Although in most human endeavors we can pretend to be something we are not, the ability to play a game well cannot be faked. People who themselves cannot hit a ball or make a tackle nevertheless can become expert at discerning the skill or lack of it of those who do such things for a living. Toughness, a synonym for physical courage, is an easily recognizable trait, especially in contact sports, for those who pursue the remorseless goal of victory. Sports also emphasize what one does right now, overshadowing past accomplishment. Each game is a new beginning, with a requirement to perform again with the knowledge that your job is always at risk and that others, equally talented, are eager to take your place. Imagine having that pressure in your job. However athletic we may be, we soon learn that our chances of earning a living playing a game are remote, because too many others are better. We need to find some other way to express courage in our lives. The most widely recognized form of courage is, again, physical, and consists of some form of military heroism. An entire graduated system of valor awards has been established to recognize courage in battle, above the risk that all soldiers assume by their willingness just to be there. Unfortunately, to bring this system to bear, we require a war. Although it is not often spoken of, part of the appeal of war is that it serves as a stage on which courage is tested and rewarded. In this sense, military service has been a traditional rite of passage for men, which explains, for example, some of the enthusiasm that has traditionally marked the onset of our military adventures, from the Civil War to Iraq. Only in retrospect do we seem to appreciate the costs of these enterprises. The award of medals for valor in combat is a notoriously flawed process, involving witness descriptions, military's need for heroes, and even the occasional requirement for a cover-up. War story. As a flight surgeon in Vietnam, part of my assignment was to provide medical services to the helicopter unit that was attached to our regiment. An officer in this unit was noted for his recklessness as well as his relentless womanizing. One day he was flying his helicopter back from Saigon with his current girlfriend on board. She was a civilian employee for a relief agency. He heard over the radio that his unit was in contact with the enemy. Against policy, he diverted to the area, and as he flew over, he ordered his door gunner to drop a white phosphorus grenade as a marker for an airstrike. The gunner pulled the pin on the grenade before discovering that the other side of the aircraft would be a better place to drop it on the target. He handed the grenade across the helicopter to the crew chief, and as he did so, the spoon flew off, activating the timer. The crew chief threw it out the door, but as it left his hand, it exploded, killing him and sending burning white phosphorus powder back into the helicopter. The pilot got some on the back of his neck, and his girlfriend, who was wearing flip-flops, got some on her feet. I met the helicopter as it arrived at the 93rd Evacuation Hospital and was enlisted in the uncomfortable task of explaining to medics in the receiving area why a female civilian had just been injured in a combat operation. Careers were at stake here, and the hospital commander was persuaded to omit this casualty from his records. The pilot received a Purple Heart and a Distinguished Flying Cross. The brave but unlucky crew chief, thanks to an enhanced description of his accidental death, received the Congressional Medal of Honor. Thus, sometimes, are heroes created. See also Silver Star citation for Corporal Pat Tillman, killed by his own unit in Afghanistan. Here is the larger point. War is so terrible in its dehumanization and destruction that it has no justification apart from national survival. When we engage in war in the absence of such an imperative, a lot of effort is directed at its one redeeming feature. It elicits acts of courage from some of those who participate. If we pay enough attention to these actions, we can distract ourselves from the corrosive impact on us and our values that unjust or unnecessary wars exact. Hence the need to characterize as heroic all of our soldiers, especially those who died. We cannot acknowledge that they died in vain without reflecting the fact that, in a democracy, we were complicit in allowing the war in the first place. So we send our young off to kill and die, while praising their sacrifices and extolling their heroism to obscure the futility of what we have asked them to do. Somehow our gratitude, "Thank you for your service," doesn't quite cover the true costs of our mistake. Missing in our search for heroes outside ourselves is any sense that we have an obligation to exhibit courage in our own lives. Recently, in a California seaside community, fire and rescue personnel watched a man drown about 100 yards offshore because they were following a policy of no water rescues that had been imposed by the town in response to budgetary constraints. No one, not any of the firemen, not one of the onlookers, went into the water to save this man. Though they described themselves later as frustrated by a rule that apparently overcame whatever moral obligation they might have felt to this drowning man. As long as we imagine that bravery requires some physical challenge, we see few opportunities to exhibit it in the relatively safe world we inhabit. A television show called What Would You Do? Depicts people's reactions to simulated situations, such as a woman being harassed by her boyfriend and a child being berated by a parent. You will not be surprised to hear that most people avoid involvement. In real life, hearing that those in distress were ignored by passers-by is commonplace. The occasional people who respond helpfully are often asked to explain why they did what few others seemed prepared to do. They are customarily at a loss to explain their reaction. What distinguishes this tiny minority appears to be a well-developed intolerance for injustice, combined with a sense of responsibility for a fellow human being who they do not know. Like any virtue, courage, a form of kindness, after all, is not randomly distributed in the population. In my lifetime, the struggle for civil rights stands out as an example of this fact. Some people gave their lives for the idea of equality before the law. Others loosed police dogs and fire hoses to defend injustice. Most of us stayed home. Chapter 14. Nothing prepares us for the terrible risk of intimacy. The answer is to show up anyway, stammering and weeping, and do the thing. Or stay in the place that engenders the fear. Susan Cheever. Of all the tasks we set for ourselves, the choice of the person with whom we expect to spend the rest of our life is the most important, and carries with it our slender and deluded hope for immortality, accepting eternity in heaven. That we are poor at making this choice is evident in the routine failures of marriage that dot the landscape. If giving our heart to another is such an important undertaking, why do we not train our young people to recognize and develop those traits of character that make for satisfying and enduring relationships? Think what you knew as a teenager, the time when you began to learn to engage in the great human experiment that you hoped would result in a lasting intimacy with another human being. Think what models you had of adults who had solved this problem in their lives. Think of what the popular culture taught you about who was hot and who was not. How did you measure up to these images? What kind of courage was required to control your insecurities enough to reach out to others and allow them to know you? We are routinely told that adolescence and young adulthood are supposed to be the happiest times of our lives. In fact, this time is fraught with failed experiments in human relationships. Because our parents and schools give us little useful information about how to live in the world, we are engaged in an exercise of trial and error learning. Some of the errors, notably social rejection, are extremely painful, and most of us develop a persona that allows us to minimize this pain. Those who have the accidental gifts of athletic ability or conventional beauty tend to do best at this stage of life. The rest of us try to control our anxieties and develop alternative identities by finding others who share our interests and our developing philosophy of what constitutes worldly success. This urge to be around like-minded peers is the basis for the universally mispronounced cliques that characterize life in high school. I recently went back to my all-male 55th high school reunion and was astonished at the different memories we all had of that time together. Gone with the years was the sense of losing the social competition that is my most vivid memory of that period. The water that had flowed under each of our bridges had washed away the feelings of not being good enough or attractive enough or smart enough to succeed in the impenetrably complicated game of life. Each of us seems to have made his separate peace with his journey, now drawing to a close, and with each other. The old pictures we passed around were of people impossibly young, with different values and no accomplishment. We felt a bond of familiarity that flowed from those years we spent together. But I think we all would have liked a moment of time travel to reassure those young faces that they would find a way to resolve their insecurities and would find someone to love them, and that life would present other things more important to worry about than adolescent anxieties. Of the many things we didn't know when we were 18, the most important was how to recognize the person who would consent to share our fates. The girls we were in contact with appeared to inhabit an alternate universe and to have limited interest in us. That they had veto power over relationships in which we were expected to take the initiative seemed especially unfair. That they had their own confusion and insecurity about not being chosen was not apparent. From our point of view, they were unreasonably withholding their approval. This perception generated some attitudes that affected many of us for a long time, notably anger at the evident unfairness and power disparity. The entire scene was a laboratory for anxiety, though we never confessed this to each other. In this environment, not surprisingly, we had trouble learning what the military calls the rules of engagement. The culture that surrounded us, which we breathed like air, suggested certain roles and behaviors that were inimical to what we were looking for, closeness and respect, though we were also unaware at the time that this was what we needed. Instead, the lessons we were taught had more to do with dominance, manipulation, and an implied contract for services that presumed specific gender-based roles that, if well played, would lead to satisfying and enduring relationships. Little did we know what awaited us when those roles became unsatisfying to women, who eventually demanded their share of the American pie that they had heretofore simply been expected to bake. Not surprisingly, the divorce rate began its climb to 50% of marriages, where it remains. We were so surprised. These changes didn't happen all at once, and not everyone was affected in the same way. We can still find marriages, especially between religious people, operating under 19th and early 20th century contracts. But in general, young people are navigating new territory when it comes to relationships. They do, however, still struggle with the question of what constitutes a successful choice of partner, whom to avoid, and whom to cherish, which character traits are dangerous and which wear well over time. Even in our old age, many of us still appear not to have grasped a fundamental truth. In our search for happiness, we are entitled to receive only that which we are prepared to give. So over the years, we have come to a different definition of what constitutes courage in our search for intimacy. Our primary fears in this venture are humiliation and rejection, which is why relationships between the sexes are so fraught with competition, and why so many marriages involve struggles for control. Some think that infidelity, traditionally the province of men, though women seem to be catching up, is simply a search for sexual variety. In my experience, however, going outside the marriage reflects deep-seated anger at one's partner and is a tactic in the power struggles that characterize so many relationships, especially those in which gender roles are blurred and the partners are expected to be on equal footing. The betrayal that infidelity represents is a profoundly hostile act that permanently alters relationships, whether or not reconciliation and forgiveness allow them to continue. If the choice is to reconstitute the marriage, both people live with the knowledge that one of them intentionally hurt the other in the most profound way. More than a violation of a promise, forsaking all others, infidelity is an unmistakable indicator for selfishness and anger on the part of someone in whom we have reposed our best hopes. A couple may have compelling reasons to stay together: children, finances, a belief that we are all imperfect and prone to mistakes. But a mask has slipped, and what has been revealed cannot be made new. Confronted by such risks, we still persist in our search for love. If we misjudge our first attempts at intimacy, we try again. The alternative is loneliness, which for most of us is intolerable for long. Sometimes we learn from our mistakes. More often, not. The rate of failure in second and third marriages is greater than that of our first attempts. We are distracted by superficial qualities and imagine that we are good judges of character when we are clearly not. This deficit in discrimination, this inability to discern who is loyal and kind and dependable over time, costs us dearly, and we may grow cynical and self-protective. And our searches go on as if love were a scarce and non-renewable resource that we must bargain for in the most self-protective way. Marriage, as an institution, is not failing us. We are failing it. Chapter 15. Life is not a rehearsal. The worst sorrows in life are not in its losses and misfortune, but in its fears. A.C. Benson. Fear can be photographed as a nearly universal expression on people's faces. Courage is expressed in actions that are, in general, impossible to capture in a single image. Many of those who display it, sometimes over a period of years, did not realize that they had such a capacity within them. Often they do not think of themselves as especially brave. I was doing my job. It was my responsibility. I did it without thinking. But courage is always an act of love that reflects a belief in something larger than ourselves. Some people are willing to die for an idea, such as freedom or truth. Others are prepared to sacrifice themselves for those they love. And still others appear to have a more inclusive sense of brotherhood that impels them to take great risks for strangers. Some are drawn to dangerous occupations as a way of testing themselves, to see whether they are brave. Our ceaseless search for heroes often leads us up the blind alley of notoriety, as with movie stars and athletes, or becomes a synonym for competence, as in the physician whose skill saves lives. There is also the formulaic story of a heretofore unknown person whose job requires taking risks that most of us do not face. This heroic status can quickly be generalized to all who put on a uniform in public service. New York's bravest. If a part of one's job description is to enter burning buildings, does one become a hero if the building collapses? How heroic is the soldier whose vehicle is blown up as he drives down the road? Presumably, in volunteering for the military, for reasons patriotic or otherwise, he assumed that risk. Is a parent who throws herself on her child to save him from a tornado exhibiting heroism, or simply the same reflex observable in nearly all animals to protect their young? Perhaps we need to expand our timeline in our search for people to admire. We daily observe those who have given a significant part of their lives to the service of others, those who have given up their chance at the conventional definition of success to work among the poor or the handicapped. In such cases, we come up against the difference between generosity and bravery. Anyone who devotes his life to helping others is undeniably generous. Most people who make this choice, however, do not assume the risk that courage requires. Parents who decide to raise a handicapped child as an alternative to institutionalization are deserving of admiration. They are giving up a significant part of the conventional vision of what it is to be a parent on behalf of the small human being who needs their care but will never be the person they dreamed of raising. All the virtues on display in such a situation, steadfastness, loyalty, commitment, make them infinitely more deserving of respect than most of the people we are taught to admire or elevate to the status of hero. Yet to call them courageous is stretching the definition of the word. We are accustomed to describing as courageous those who regain their health after serious illness or injury. But did they have a choice? People who decide to parent double-digit numbers of children, born to them or adopted, are commonly celebrated. Perhaps I have seen too many of these situations that have not worked out well for these kids for me to join in the applause. While love may be infinite, time is not. At some point, we cannot give enough of ourselves to each child in a huge family, occasionally with disastrous results. I am especially dubious about cultures and religions that demand full quivers of children so that their faith or philosophy can be carried by their children as arrows into the future. This instrumental view of parenthood smacks of a certainty of righteousness that meets the needs of parents at the expense of the independent people our children will become. If courage is a virtue worth cultivating, how do we do so in a world in which a constant push exists to reduce risk? We train our children to be safe, to be wary of strangers, to fasten their seatbelts, to look both ways before crossing the street. We cannot bear the thought of losing them to carelessness. We hover over them as if we can protect them from all harm. The message we are sending to them with our concern is that unnecessary risk is to be avoided. Where are the trials, the rites of passage, that characterize primitive societies in which risk is accepted as inevitable? Instead of requiring that they kill a lion, we put our kids through bar mitzvahs, test their driving ability, or make it legal for them to drink alcohol. Contact sports remain the only real tests of physical determination and effort for those who care about such things. People who devote themselves to academic excellence are usually rewarded, but this is an essentially self-centered pursuit of little immediate benefit to others. The things that preoccupy our young people these days are nearly all the pursuits of the self-involved. The social media that occupy so much of their time are designed for those who imagine that the minutiae of their lives are of interest to others. It is hard to read many tweets or look at many Facebook pages without a sense that informing others about our most insignificant thoughts and activities betrays only how superficial and trivial they are. We appear to have accepted narcissism as a healthy character trait and are training an entire generation to adopt it. When a prominent figure in the society is found to be using his Twitter account to send explicit pictures of himself, we are gleefully shocked. He has gone too far in sharing his admiration of himself. The rest of us are just keeping our friends informed of everything we are thinking and doing. We are rendering ourselves stupid by filling our brains with trivia to the exclusion of whatever more important information or knowledge might reside there if we were given to reflection. A virtuous society is inhabited by virtuous people. To acquire the traits that allow us to act generously toward each other, we must have people to admire who display them, who can serve as examples to the rest of us. Where are we to find such people? Who are most visible, celebrated by the media, followed by photographers, and handed microphones so that they might entertain us? We who do not qualify for such attention seek it out. We line up to participate in reality shows. We jostle others to be on television, however briefly. Look at those people in crowd scenes holding up signs, waving and screaming maniacally when a camera is pointed at them. Who are they waving at? For that moment, they exist in a way not usually available to them as anonymous members of the audience. Not long ago, at a performance in Las Vegas, Cher made a grand entrance in a gilded cage over the heads of the crowd. When she arrived on stage, she said, "You know, if I fell out of that thing, tomorrow's headline would read, 'Cher killed in freak accident.' Underneath, it would say, 5 faceless fans also die when she falls on them." She concluded with the moral of the story: I love being famous. Most of us come to accept the reality that we are spectators to a show in which we will never be expected to perform. This perception of ourselves is why, if something happens in front of us that invites action or intervention, our first impulse is to watch rather than to act, particularly if we perceive a risk. From our largest spectacles to the private struggles of the people around us, we have been trained to be passive observers. Our television screens have been so long filled with pain, injustice, and inhumanity that most of us have lost our capacity for outrage and action, especially if the faces we see are a different color or from a distant place. Without our being aware of it, our souls have withered, and we turn away or imagine that what we are seeing could not happen to us or those we love. We are worse than cowards, who at least know what they should do. We have become numbed and helpless in the face of human suffering. We change the channel to something more entertaining. Chapter 16. Courage is like love. It must have hope to nourish it. People react to fear, not love. They don't teach that in Sunday school, but it's true. Richard Nixon. Hopelessness is the ultimate failure of imagination. The most prosaic form of courage is a willingness to get out of bed each morning and continue our lives. In the face of work that does not inspire us, relationships that have become stale and weighted with failed expectations, a world that little resembles the dreams of our youth, most of us choose to go on. What gives us hope that things will change for the better? This is the essential question in psychotherapy, which is defined as conversation directed at change, and is expressed in a more succinct question with which I confront patients. What's next? We waste a lot of time thinking about the past, or that version of it that we choose to explain the present. We frequently talk about the importance of hope without specifying what we are hoping for. For hope to be genuine, it must be realistic. Otherwise, it is but a dream. Visualize the long lines that form at lottery outlets when the payoff reaches hundreds of millions of dollars. My state lottery has as its motto, "You've got to play to win." A more realistic slogan would be, "You've got to play to lose." Obviously, hope impels people to stand in those lines, discussing how they will spend their winnings. The problem is that this hope is undone by odds that make it unrealistic and result in many spending money they cannot afford. The hope for miracles also provides fertile ground for those who would sell us cancer cures, effortless weight loss programs, real estate with no money down, natural remedies, untold wealth from Nigeria, or shortcuts to finding the perfect mate. Those who tell others how to live don't get rich advocating perseverance, loyalty, or years of education. Where's the fun in that? We're in love with new ideas, the big score, the sudden transformation. We ignore the truth that I have written about elsewhere. Only bad things happen quickly. Why do most kids hate school? Why is the slow acquisition of knowledge boring? Why do we appear to have such short historical memories? Why does the stock market fluctuate so unpredictably, exactly like one's bankroll in a Las Vegas casino? All these things occur because we are distracted from the real purpose of our lives by a dream of effortless success, narrowly defined in our culture as the accumulation of worldly goods. The core concept of capitalism, that we can all prosper together, has given way to a kind of societal selfishness that is an invitation to class conflict based on envy and a sense of unfairness. An expression of and an outlet for the longing to be rich is the false idea that we, too, with a little luck, can have it all. What is lost in such fragile hopes is the concept of pride in our work. The satisfaction that comes with doing our jobs well and the knowledge that we can construct a comfortable, if not extravagant, life as a result of our labors. Stalked by recession, unemployment, home foreclosures, stagnating income, jobs moving overseas, and endless warfare, we can easily grow angry and cynical. When this anger is redirected at minorities, immigrants, gay people, government workers, we are in danger of becoming fragmented along the lines of race and class, prisoners of our fear that there is not enough to go around and that we must each act in our own economic interest. This formula relinquishes the central idea of the society, interdependence, that we are all in this together and will succeed or fail based on our ability to cooperate with and care about others. If everything worthwhile in this life, education, loving relationships, occupational skill, the development of civic virtue, requires sustained effort, who will teach us to let go of the idea of instant gratification? The degree to which we covet the latest electronic gadget bodes ill for this effort. Are the thoughts being shared on a $500 iPhone any more compelling than those we used to write down and put in a mailbox? Have you read anything significant on Twitter recently? How many Facebook friends do you have? How many of them could you count on for help at 3 a.m.? To face the future with courage, we must believe that we have the power, the resolve, and the tolerance to contribute to a world that we and our children will want to live in. Americans have much of which to be proud, and some things of which to be ashamed. To get where we want to go, we must have at least general agreement on where we have been. We need, in other words, to know our history. Our forebears created a system of democratic government that has been a beacon to all who would live in freedom, but they also tolerated slavery. We won the wars, hot and cold, against fascism and communism, but we also interned our fellow citizens based on their race. We think of ourselves as peace-loving, while spending more on our military than do all other nations combined. We elected a black president, but discrimination against others for inborn circumstances such as race, sexual orientation, and national origin persists. We may be exceptional, but like all humans, we are fallible and given to the conceit of those who have easier lives than most. As a psychiatrist, I sell hope in individual doses. I listen to people's stories, question their fundamental beliefs about themselves, and try to help them identify and change those parts of their lives that are keeping them from being happy or fulfilled. My view of how people in groups see themselves and each other is informed by my belief that much of what we think we know is untrue, and most of our behavior is driven by desires and motives of which we are only dimly aware. I also believe that insight, generosity, and tolerance are not inborn traits, but can be taught. We just have to identify those among us who are qualified to lead and teach us. They must be intelligent and devoted to the principles of kindness and hope. If, instead, we elevate those who are stupid or arrogant or both, we will get the future we deserve. Chapter 17. Punishment and revenge are the favored responses of fearful people. To hate and to fear is to be psychologically ill. It is, in fact, the consuming illness of our time. Harry A. Overstreet. What is fear other than anticipation of the worst? From the smallest threat, we can conjure disaster. Learning how to tolerate, even embrace uncertainty with an anticipation of good outcomes leavened by the reality of risk underlies every conception of courage. As with all things, the middle road between fear and complacency is the only path upon which we can pursue happiness in the face of our mortality. If it is true that in life we are more likely to get not what we deserve, but what we expect, how can we adjust our expectations in the direction of optimism without becoming naive? In our interactions with other people, we betray what we anticipate by the way we behave, our facial expression, the tone of our voice. How many times have we seen visibly irritated people at airline counters or hotel registration desks, testing the patience of those trying to help them? Among the most revealing behaviors in our repertoire are the way we treat those who are providing us a service. Waiters, retail clerks, cab drivers. These interactions are so important that I routinely ask about them when talking to those questioning whether to proceed with marriage to a particular person. Self-absorbed people tend to have unrealistic expectations about how the world will accommodate them and are inflexible and easily angered under stress. The expectation that the world will recognize their specialness and usher them to the head of the line often evokes resentment that results in poorer rather than better service. In the area of healthcare, for example, I have witnessed enough medical mistakes to know that some people have more trouble than others getting good care. Some such errors are randomly distributed and the fault of providers. Others appear to be a commentary on the patience of the patient. For example, one woman I know was notoriously critical and demanding of the nursing staff. But she wondered why she had trouble getting her call button answered and was the victim of an above-average number of errors in her medication dosages. These events, of course, only reinforced her convictions about the general incompetence of her caregivers. Our choice of attitude and its consequences is important in how we confront our fears. Survivors of natural disasters, shocked by the devastation around them, routinely talk about rebuilding. The pastor stands in the ruins of his church, faith intact. Because God's ways are beyond our comprehension, he gets all the credit and none of the blame, whatever happens. First among our fears, it seems, is the loneliness implicit in the idea that we might live in an indifferent universe. Somewhere between the narcissistic belief that we individually are the center of creation and the conception that we are actors in a preordained play is a large area in which we operate under the constraints of time and chance, but still have choices about how to live. Whether our lives are dominated by anxiety and selfishness, or we choose to cope with our fears through generosity and tolerance, determines the kind of world we create for ourselves and each other. This dichotomy of behavior is seldom discussed when we argue about decisions concerning standards of personal conduct or philosophies of government. But all our conceptions of how to live, individually and collectively, hinge on beliefs about our responsibilities toward each other and our respect for people's rights to live in ways different from our own. We are in danger here of a self-fulfilling prophecy, in which some are permanently disadvantaged by a social system that favors the wealthy and neglects or punishes the less powerful. Such unfairness produces a resentment and cynicism that poison our attempts to live peacefully with one another. These battles may be fought on grounds of constitutionalism and the role of government in our lives, but the underlying issues of fairness, fear, and civic duty must be brought into the debate if we are to reach an understanding. Not since we fought a civil war over slavery, another disagreement over what it means to be human, have the stakes been as high. Chapter 18. Life shrinks or expands in proportion to one's courage. The important thing is this: to be able at any moment to sacrifice what we are for what we could become. Charles Du Bois. The size and shape of the lives we lead depend on our ability to engage with others about ideas and emotions. No one is born with a heart full of feelings and a head full of thoughts, so we are in a more or less continuous state of learning. To open ourselves to other people and new experiences requires a special sort of humility that resists the forces of calcified prejudice. I have found that much of what passes for conventional wisdom is untrue. An example of this deficit in thinking is contained in the aphorism, "What does not kill us makes us stronger." These words, misguided and false, are frequently offered to those grieving a serious loss in their lives. Bereaved parents hear this maxim as a form of consolation and are left to contemplate how anyone can be strengthened by the death of their child. Good relationships require hard work is another truism that I think of as a probable commentary on the marriage of the person offering it. Clichés foster a kind of pseudo-knowledge that clutters our brains, impeding our ability to think about old problems in a new way. Viewed unsparingly, most of our troubles, though they may seem unique to us, are old and have been confronted by many others before us. Knowing this, we face the truth that our only choice when we have been wounded is how to react. The process of grief, for example, is one of intense self-absorption. We are, after the loss of someone we love, like soldiers who have been pinned down in combat, afraid to move, but knowing that if we do not, our lives are over. We've been trained to respond passively to misfortune. I think of this as the medical model of crisis management. When we become sick or are injured, we are taught to rest and let someone else minister to us. If we are very sick, we are placed in hospitals where we are put to bed in ridiculous gowns and are expected, like children, to follow orders from the people in charge. Little emphasis is given to participating in our own care or doing anything ourselves that might foster healing. In many other areas of our lives, we put ourselves in the hands of experts who presume to advise us on how to live. This attitude is a major problem in psychotherapy. Many patients come to me expecting sage advice and prescriptions for medication that will alter their emotional lives for the better. Among my harder tasks is to convince them that the answers must come from within them, and that it is my job to ask the questions that will enable them to find solutions that fit their lives. I can serve as a source of accountability for changing their lives in the desired direction. I can also correct some misconceptions about their predicaments and tell them what I have learned over the years about emotional healing, especially the importance of hope. Many people are intolerant of such an approach, which expects them to take responsibility for themselves, and leave disappointed that I cannot offer them the rapid and definitive solutions they desire. Whenever I invoke courage in undertaking the process of change, I know that I am flying in the face of societal expectations. Few of our institutions, apart from the military and sports, ever mention the importance of being brave in the face of adversity. It seems to me ironic that one of the newer diagnoses to sweep across the psychiatric landscape is adult attention deficit disorder, that form of distractibility that has as its treatment the regular use of stimulant drugs, including methamphetamine. I remember the seriousness with which psychiatry not so long ago considered multiple personality disorder, recovered memory syndrome, and various forms of addiction, including shopping and viewing pornography. We often attach a diagnostic label to certain behaviors, such as drinking, as a means of relieving stigma and encouraging participation in a 12-step program. Unfortunately, the implication that some people suffer from an illness also relieves them from some of the individual responsibility for change and relapse. If they are sick, how can we hold them accountable? Alcoholics Anonymous, with its emphasis on abstinence and with a low tolerance for excuses, has been the most successful form of treatment for those who drink to excess. Extending this model to gambling and promiscuous sex may work for some, but the idea that every bad habit deserves a diagnosis ignores the reality that most human behavior, good and bad, is habitual, and that both vice and virtue are commentaries on how we see ourselves in relation to others. The psychopaths in our midst, for example, unencumbered by conscience, are only doing what they perceive to be in their self-interest. They are not sick, nor do they want to change. The courtroom, not the mental health clinic, is the appropriate place to deal with them. Those who do want to change habitual behaviors must invoke their capacity for courage and determination. If they can find a group that encourages them to do so, they are fortunate. But first, they need to stop watching talk shows that encourage them to feel like victims of circumstance. The traumas of our youth, including our imperfect parents, no doubt played a role in our adult distress, but are an insufficient excuse for our current refusal to change unwanted behaviors. Recognizing that we have the freedom to choose is a hallmark of mental health. In the grip of anxiety or depression, we have fewer choices because our lives are circumscribed by our avoidance behaviors. Years ago, I had a patient who was terrified of birds. When outside, she was constantly on the alert for them. She would cross the street to avoid them. We looked at pictures of birds, and later I brought a caged bird from a nearby pet shop into the sessions. Eventually, I was able to release the bird in the room. At our last meeting, she came in a dress covered with images of birds. Her life had been expanded and made easier because she had the determination to rid herself of this irrational apprehension. Most of our anxieties are, of course, more complicated and involve relationships with other people. And yet the willingness to confront what we fear remains the touchstone of successful treatment. The only word for this belief in our own capacity to heal is courage. Chapter 19. Cowardice is the incapacity to love anything but oneself. The human race is a race of cowards, and I am not only marching in that procession, but carrying a banner. Mark Twain. Of all the disadvantages of our congenital narcissism, the challenge of devoting our lives to people and ideas apart from ourselves remains paramount. What is required to engage cooperative and unselfish behavior? A well-known religious self-help book begins with these words, "It's not about you." Whatever it is, life presumably, the objective appears to be to stop being so self-absorbed and turn our faces toward God. I've never liked this idea. but not because it invokes the power of faith. Countless examples of good works have been performed in the name of religion. My objection to using religious belief as the primary basis for morality is that such a conviction is another way of attributing our difficulties to people and forces outside ourselves, and over which we have little control. To say that God is the source of all virtue is similar to attributing our individual limitations to our past experience. Both beliefs diminish our own responsibility for behaving well in the present and constructing a future of which we can be proud, whether or not it includes salvation for our immortal souls. Just as one can be brave in many ways, cowardice takes different forms. We all have situations and people who intimidate us physically. By the time we finish elementary school, most of us have some experience of bullying. If we have not been bullied ourselves, we have seen others picked on because of some physical or emotional departure from the group norm. Our reaction to this first hint of life's unfairness is usually to endure or try to ignore it, particularly if it is happening to someone else. And so is set in motion the familiar bystander phenomenon, in which we attempt to avoid things that do not directly affect us. Such an attitude is good preparation for the kind of cowardice that will enable us to walk or drive by our fellow human beings in distress on city streets, or to avert our eyes from the many other forms of injustice that the world contains. How many people can we be expected to care about, after all? Self-centeredness, usually thought of in individual terms, can also apply to those whom we see as belonging to the same tribe. If you draw a diagram showing personal attachments, you will discover who really matters to you. Our core loyalties are to our family, friends, and members of our immediate community, however we define community. Those we care about tend to be people like us, in race, education, and social class. These allegiances can be further extended to include regional or national attachments, but seldom extend much beyond that. Circumscribed loyalty is why it is easier to ignore or even kill those who are discernibly different from us in language, ethnicity, or religion. This fact is the basis for the dehumanization of the enemy that accompanies every war. By virtue of being different, their lives are somehow less valuable. And so our sense of responsibility for or caring about others is a test of inclusiveness. The degree of risk we are willing to take on behalf of other human beings is a test of our attachment to them, which is why unit cohesiveness is so important to the military. If the mutual welfare of those in a unit becomes a dominant value, people will routinely take life-threatening risks on each other's behalf. Band of Brothers is an apt description of an infantry unit in combat. People are much more likely to hazard their lives for a person than an idea. Personal survival and caring for each other's welfare are the primary reasons for fighting bravely. In fact, the willingness to risk one's life on behalf of another is the operational definition of love. Cowardice may be thought of as surrender to fear. This emotion represents the flight alternative in the well-known fight-or-flight phenomenon that oversimplifies the human response to danger. In any threatening situation, risk assessment is critical to survival. If we are confronted by overwhelming force, we are behaving adaptively to try to escape rather than fight and die. In the modern world, we seldom face occasions in which our lives are threatened. Instead, we are more likely to encounter our fellow human beings in distress and simply have to decide whether and how much we are prepared to help them. Cowardice is usually not the word applied to willingness to tolerate injustice, perhaps because each of us is aware of situations in which we ought to have acted in someone's defense, yet chose not to. And we know that how we behave in such instances is a measure of our sense of common humanity. Whatever the source for our morality, religious, philosophical, or situational, we all know that the protection of the weak from exploitation by the strong is a fundamental obligation of any civilized person. My local library is participating in a program designed to improve our interactions with each other. At the various library branches, one can pick up bumper stickers that read, "Choose Civility." After being cut off by a few vehicles bearing this message, I have been tempted to get a bumper sticker that reads, "Forget Civility, learn how to drive." The appeal to politeness on the road is laudable, but I think that more than courtesy is required of us if we are to sustain our commitments to each other. I would opt for a bumper sticker that said simply, "Courage." Except that I doubt most people would understand such a cryptic message any more than they did when Dan Rather ended his CBS newscast years ago with this attempt at encouragement. Chapter 20. Honesty is a prerequisite for courage. When I am honest, I am automatically humble. Hugh Prather. My first exposure to large-scale lying came when I was a platoon leader with the 82nd Airborne Division in 1961. President Kennedy was scheduled to pay a visit to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to inspect our readiness to intervene anywhere in the world. The division was laid out on the airfield, with each battle group dressed for combat in a different environment. One battle group wore uniforms for jungle fighting, another was in brown for desert warfare. My battle group was clothed all in white and posing with skis to demonstrate our readiness to fight on some frozen landscape in northern Europe or Asia. It was darkly humorous that many of my men had never seen snow, much less trained to fight in it. Like most Army units at the time, the 82nd was well below full strength, so among our ranks that day were soldiers from various support units at Bragg, cooks, truck drivers, clerks, most of whom were not even parachute qualified. We must have made an impressive picture as Air Force One slowly circled the airfield. I wondered if it was a good idea for the president to be under the impression that he was looking at a full-strength, combat-ready airborne division, available on short notice to fight wherever the country needed them. Any decision to overcome fear must be accompanied by a realistic assessment of resources, risk, and a rational decision about whether the outcome is worth the hazard. Sometimes, as in battle, there is little time to think. The choice to throw oneself on a grenade to save people nearby may be a reflex, but one born of a commitment previously undertaken. Most acts that we think of as courageous are the product of some reflection. The passengers on United Flight 93 on September 11th had time to contemplate their predicament. They had news of other airliners being flown into buildings, and so came to understand their certain fate if they did nothing. Within minutes, they were able to make the decision to fight to gain control of the cockpit and organize themselves to confront the hijackers. Their telephone conversations with people on the ground reveal both fear and a determination to try to save themselves. Few of us are likely to be confronted with such life-threatening decisions. The fears we face are, in general, long-term and involve questions related to how to find meaningful work, to take care of each other, to figure out whom to love, to meet our obligations to those who depend on us, to cope with the depredations of age, and finally, to face our mortality. Few of us are taught systematically about the importance of these tasks, much less how to accomplish them. Instead, the culture is oriented toward distraction and entertainment and preoccupied with safety. Honesty as a value is honored more in the breach than in the observance. Stories of people returning found money are much less numerous than those that illustrate the many ways we take advantage of one another. The process of being elected to office, especially high office, is driven by relentless ambition and routinely involves fraud and dissembling. An honest politician has become an oxymoron. Hypocrisy, the worst form of dishonesty, is at once an object of our contempt and accepted as an occupational hazard among those who would deceive us for power or profit. The widespread cynicism that this reality produces undermines the trust essential to any political system that depends on the consent of the governed. Of all the phenomena that have come to characterize the American political process, the rise of disrespect, even hatred, on the part of those who disagree on matters of religion or politics is perhaps the most ominous development. Some characterize this display as a decline in civility, but it is more than that. The attribution of ill will or a lack of patriotism to one's opponents bespeak a loss of faith in our ability to listen to, learn from, and compromise with each other. Ignorance, anger, and fear are coexisting traits that have come to distort the public discourse, leading to all manner of conspiracy theories and delusional beliefs. Science itself is discounted in arguments over topics such as evolution and climate change. When we abandon the scientific method as a way of understanding the world, we take leave of reason, and any assertion, no matter how crazy, can become a fixed belief. Nature itself is intolerant of stupidity. If one is disoriented in the wilderness or lost at sea, survival depends on an ability to navigate and find food. We may be insulated from such harsh reality by the conveniences of modern life and the proximity of the local supermarket, but we are still in danger of losing our way individually and as a society if we lose the capacity to listen to each other and act in a way that benefits all. We cannot allow ourselves to be lied to, or worse, engage in a process of self-deception. In psychotherapy, I am continually confronted with this problem. I point out to people that many things we believe about ourselves turn out to be untrue. As examples, I cite the three great lies that nearly all of us tell ourselves. I'm a good driver. I have a good sense of humor. I'm a good judge of character. That these are characteristics that we all share is evidently not true. But each of us clings to the belief that we are the exception. We need each other if we are to construct a courageous society. As long as we are not alone, there is nothing that we cannot face. And we are never out of options. In the desperation of the concentration camps of World War II, the psychiatrist Viktor Frankl concluded that the last human freedom is the ability to choose the attitude with which we meet our fate. Courage begins with understanding. If we learned to be more honest with ourselves about our strengths and our failings, perhaps we would be in a position to demand more from those we choose to lead us. Here is the truth. We are all fallible, and none of us is selfless. Some of us have even made a virtue of selfishness. No one has all the answers, and we all deserve tolerance for our shortcomings. But we need to be as truthful with ourselves as we can be, so that we can demand honesty and forbearance from those we select to make decisions about the common good.